Hello, this is your Polycast for Wednesday, April 29th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, the House passes a Republican-backed health bill that cuts $1 billion in spending. The push for Sunday liquor store sales is likely dead for the session, and not all Minnesota businesses want the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Early this morning, the Minnesota House passed a Health and Human Services budget bill that cuts about $1 billion in health care programs. The measure passed 72-60, with all Democrats voting against it. Republicans say the bill aims to protect the state's most vulnerable residents and spends more money on nursing homes. But the measure also eliminates the state-subsidized health insurance program, MinnesotaCare, and delays payments to insurance companies. Republican Representative Matt Dean of Delwood says the cuts will help control rising health care costs.
If we do not get a handle on Medicaid spending and on our overall HHS spending, we can never, ever get to where we want to be in higher ed or K-12 or any of the other areas that are suffering because this area is growing unsustainably fast, and we know that.
Democrats criticized Republicans for counting $285 million in savings in the bill that they can't account for. House Minority Leader Paul Thiessen of Minneapolis said Republicans are basing their cuts on savings that don't exist.
I don't ever remember us passing a bill off the House floor, members, with a $285 million hole in the budget. If you're a fiscal conservative, do you really want to pass a budget that has a $285 million hole in your budget? Is that what a family would do when you're doing a family budget?
Democrats also argued there's no need to cut health care programs when the state has a budget surplus of nearly $2 billion. The House bill has to be reconciled with proposals from Senate Democrats and DFL Governor Mark Dayton. Those proposals call for significantly higher spending on health programs. The state House voted yesterday to keep in place the state's longtime ban on Sunday liquor sales. Tim Pugmire reports.
By a vote of 75-57, lawmakers rejected an amendment to a larger liquor policy bill that would have allowed local municipalities to decide whether liquor stores can open on Sundays. Supporters argued that Minnesota is losing business to neighboring states. But DFL Representative John Considine of Mankato said he can't find a local liquor store that wants the change.
To me, this looks like an all-out assault on mom-and-pop liquor stores. They will incur an additional 52 days a year of overhead with almost no appreciable increase in revenue.
The state Senate rejected a Sunday sales measure earlier this month. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Governor Dayton has put an end to the placement of radio collars on moose for research. The order comes after several adult moose died after being collared and after several moose mothers abandoned their calves. But some scientists worry the move will make it more difficult to learn what's killing the state's moose population. Dan Crocker has more.
2 years ago, the DNR launched an ambitious first-of-its-kind study to try to figure out why the state's iconic moose were dying in huge numbers. The DNR estimates there are now only about 3,500 moose in northeast Minnesota, down from 8,000 only 9 years ago. The key to the study was placing high-tech GPS tracking collars on the moose. That allowed researchers to quickly recover the body of a dead moose before it was scavenged to find out exactly what killed it. But in some cases, the act of collaring the moose killed them. The severe stress involved with capture can kill adult moose, and calves are often abandoned by their mothers and left vulnerable to predators. This winter, the number of collaring-related deaths spiked beyond what researchers expected. Those unintended consequences prompted Governor Dayton to order an end to the practice.
You can study, and that information is good, but when you're damaging the breed that you're trying to study, it's just not right.
This winter, researchers placed collars on 32 adult moose. 5 died shortly after capture. And the problem has been even worse with calves. 16 out of 74 calves collared by researchers were abandoned by their mothers. 10 died. The rest were taken to zoos. Dayton says after wolves, the researchers were the next leading cause of death.
We know the wolves are the number one predator. We know we're now taking away the number two cause of mortality, which is human beings putting collars on them. So I think we made a step in the right direction for the preservation of the moose population.
DNR biologists leading the moose study were not made available for comment. Commissioner Tom Landwehr says they were disappointed with the governor's decision, but he says he supports it.
You know, the governor doesn't ask his commissioners to always be in agreement with him, but I would offer that, you know, we do agree with the governor on this one. It was time to pull a plug on this project.
But Landwehr says researchers will continue to study the 99 adult moose that still have collars.
We'll continue to get really good information on adults from the cohort that's got the collars on. It's our intention to continue that work.
But the calf study will end, since researchers won't be able to collar more calves this spring. Researchers are starting to get a clearer picture of the complex mix of factors killing Minnesota's moose. So far, wolves have killed more than half the collared moose, although many of those moose killed were already sick. The other deaths were health-related, caused by brainworm, winter ticks, or other factors. Moose calves were killed primarily by predators, both wolves and bears. The collars have also provided other important information. Ron Moen is a biologist at UMD who will no longer be allowed to collar moose. He says he's used the collars to track where moose move in the forest.
And so we can look at, for example, how moose are responding to warmer temperatures, where they're going.
He says that information can be used to help create more of the habitat moose need to survive. Scientists with the Grand Portage Band of Chippewa are also studying moose habitat. Band biologist Seth Moore says the band has collars on 35 moose on and near the reservation, and they intend to collar 10 to 15 calves next month. He says unless he hears otherwise from band leadership, the governor's order won't change his plans.
My intention at this point in time is to continue doing what we're doing. I know that we're doing good science, and that science is going to steer how we manage moose populations to benefit them. And I feel very good about that.
Moore says they have not had any mothers abandon calves and says their post-capture mortality rate for adults is less than 2%. He says no one likes to lose a moose during research, but what scientists are learning, Moore says, could help them ensure that the animal remains an iconic part of Minnesota. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
The United States Senate could vote this week to give President Obama authority to finish negotiating a trade treaty known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Congress would then have to accept or reject the deal with no changes. Organized labor has come out strongly against a possible deal, saying it would push down wages for American workers. Business groups are generally supportive of more international trade, but Minnesota's business community is far from united on the Pacific trade deal. Brett Neely has the story.
Exports make up less than 10% of Minnesota's economy. But for those businesses engaged in international trade, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a hot topic. The medical device sector is Minnesota's biggest export industry, making up more than $3.7 billion worth of exports last year. And Shay Mandel, the head of the local trade group, Life Science Alley, likes the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He says it would give Minnesota manufacturers more access to important markets.
And then you have other countries that are growing rapidly, countries like Mexico, some of the South American countries, Singapore, where, you know, we think there's a lot more opportunity.
Even more importantly, says Mandel, are greater protections for the patents and trade secrets of American firms.
The lifeblood of medical technology, biotechnology, pharmaceuticals is intellectual property.
Minnesota's soy and corn crops could also see bigger markets overseas due to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, says Kevin Papp, president of the Minnesota Farm Bureau.
Trade is very important in this country. We grow more than we can use, and we need those markets overseas.
Still, not every Minnesota farmer has had a rosy experience with trade. The 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement opened the door to more imports of Mexican sugar, which hurt sugar beet farmers in Minnesota's Red River Valley, says David Berg, CEO of American Crystal Sugar.
It took 15 full years before it really hit us, and when it hit like a ton of bricks. It was a disaster for the U.S. sugar market.
This time around, Berg says the domestic sugar industry wants to make sure that import quotas that protect it stay in place. Berg says he's encouraged by what Obama administration officials have told sugar producers.
I think the key phrase that they've used is that they won't do anything in this negotiation that would undermine U.S. sugar policies.
Other industries are hopeful this agreement will pry open markets that haven't been very accessible. Despite the NAFTA agreement, Canada's dairy markets remain relatively closed to American imports, says David Scavel, a dairy farmer in southeastern Minnesota.
In order to get Canada to the table and to get them serious about negotiating, we need the TPA to let them know we're serious.
One prominent Minnesota industry has grave concerns about the trade deal, taconite mining. More than 1,000 miners have been laid off this year as falling steel prices have led to a glut of lower-priced foreign imports. Scott Paul is the president of the American Alliance for Manufacturing, a trade group that's made up of the major steelmakers and the United Steelworkers Union. Paul says past trade deals allowed foreign trading partners to manipulate their currencies to keep their imports cheaper.
They're at least partially responsible for some of the poor jobs performance in manufacturing that we've seen over the last 20 years.
In Minnesota, it's an argument the state's Democratic members of Congress have taken seriously. They're almost entirely opposed to giving Obama negotiating authority. But so far, Paul says those arguments haven't gotten wider traction.
We don't have an import shortage, but we still have a jobs situation in the United States, and I would think that that would help to inform the debate and shape the rules of the agreement. But so far, it hasn't.
There's still some time left to debate the merits of the trade pact. If Congress gives Obama the negotiating authority and he reaches an agreement, Congress will have 2 additional months to debate whether to ratify it. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
And that's your Polycast for this Wednesday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.